Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's overturning of the Republican Pennsylvania voter ID law that analysts claim would have disenfranchised a million Democratic voters. Dr. Terry Madonna, who directs the Franklin and Marshall College poll and is a pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News, joins us to discuss how Republican efforts to suppress the Democratic vote in this key swing state appear to have backfired. Then we will speak with the President of Public Citizen, Robert Weissman, about an important ruling that struck down a key part of the Dodd-Frank law to regulate speculation on oil and commodity prices. We'll examine the concerted legal and political campaign by those on Wall Street responsible for ruining the economy, along with their Republican allies, to cripple and kill the Dodd-Frank laws passed in response to the 2008 financial meltdown. Then finally, we will look into the key power broker who more than anyone else is trying to both buy and steal the 2012 election for the Republicans, Karl Rove. Craig Unger, the author of the new book Boss Rove, Inside Karl Rove's Secret Kingdom of Power, joins us to discuss the resurrection of one of the most powerful political operators in American history who is determined to prevent Democrats from voting and re-electing President Obama. And joining us now is Dr. Terry Madonna, who's a professor of public affairs and director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College, where he directs the Franklin and Marshall College poll. He has written extensively about voters and voting behavior and founded the Keystone poll in 1992, the oldest survey produced exclusively in Pennsylvania, which was renamed the Franklin and Marshall College poll. He is the pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News and many other newspapers and television stations in Pennsylvania. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Terry Madonna.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And the ruling by the Commonwealth Court Judge Robert Simpson, who originally ruled in favor of the new strict voter ID law, now reversed himself. Did this happen because of testimony? So many people testified that said saying that they weren't going to be able to vote.
Look, the Supreme Court remanded it back to this judge, and the court was very clear. It said, your job is to tell the voter, to tell us, to tell the citizens of the state whether, in fact, there will be people disenfranchised for this year's general election, if these six forms of photo ID are permitted to stand. And he reached the conclusion that, in fact, people would be disenfranchised. So what he did was, in a sense, pretty ingenious. In April, when we had the Pennsylvania primary, there was a practice run where you were asked to provide an ID, one of the appropriate IDs that are required under Pennsylvania's law. If you didn't have one, however, they let you vote and your vote counted. He said, let's have a do-over. Let's do the same thing. And you can I won't throw out the entire law. The law's provisions can still stand, meaning you got to provide an ID, but if you don't have one, we're going to let you vote anyway. And by the way, continue the practice of getting people to sign up for one of the appropriate IDs, find one or whatever. There are a bunch of ways to come up with those six ID forms that are required in the law. He did not explicitly say it's constitutional. He just simply said we're going to keep the law in effect except for these provisions dealing with voters who don't have one of the six forms.
So what's extraordinary, though, is that in these legal wranglings going on over the new Republican voter ID law, lawyers on both sides admit there are no known cases of in-person
correct.
Voter fraud. So
that's correct.
This is a problem in search of a solution in search of a problem.
Yeah. Well, look, and that's exactly right. And I've looked at this and studied this for many years. The fraud that exists, not just in Pennsylvania, but around the country, is usually not voter impersonation fraud. It's usually election officials that are complicit, that are involved in it. And even the Commonwealth, when it made its case defending the law, said that we're not going to defend it on the basis of whether there's, in fact, voter ID fraud. You're exactly right. So You know, they defended it on other grounds. But the point is that it's now in a sense in limbo, meaning that it's in effect, but people can vote. And I think that's, you know, a victory for, and by the way, on the, you know, just so full disclosure here, I wrote a regular column in which I expressed my concerns about it. Didn't, you know, Pennsylvania had a voter ID law before that no one complained about. This was for first-time voters. You could take a rent receipt, and it wasn't controversial. You didn't have to have one of the, quote, six forms. That's the problem, the restrictive nature of these six forms. And so I think we'll have to wait to see if there's an appeal. Probably not much going to change. Remember, we're, what, a little more than 30 days away from the election. Tinkering now with what voters can bring or not bring would probably be a mistake, you know, just in terms of the electorate, just in terms of, and the election officials that, after all, have to enforce whatever, you know, rules are in place.
So if there's no such thing as voter fraud, and both sides agree with this in terms of the attorneys arguing this voter ID case in Pennsylvania, we know that the Republican leader, I think, of the House, in a moment of accidental candor, said that this new law is going to deliver the state of Pennsylvania to Mitt Romney. What is, let's speculate about what the real motives then of this law is.
I think you're right. I mean, I think the motive was to help the Republicans in the election. And by the way, in some respects, it backfired. I mean, there are 170 organizations by one count in Pennsylvania helping to register voters, you know, helping them to figure out, you know, to get the right ID. Motivated Democrats. I think in the long run, the law helped the Democrats more than it hurt them. Now, look, we don't know for sure, and the judge couldn't give a specific number as to how many people might try to vote and not have one of the appropriate IDs and then have to cast what we call a provisional ballot, which would allow you to vote, and then within 6 days, you would have to show one of the appropriate IDs. And no one believed that within 6 days it would be possible to do that in most cases. And so he said, no, we're going to just get rid of all that for now. We're going to put that in limbo. But go back to your point, it's really difficult to say how many people would actually have been involved, you know, affected by it. But in the end, I think it motivated Democrats. The Republicans got a lot of bad press about it. Not just, you know, not liberal, not, you know, just bad ink for, you know, this effort, which a lot of people think was just ill-devised. I mean, you know, there's no lot of evidence of fraud. There's no evidence of fraud. I think there was one study in Philadelphia that showed some, you know, infinitesimal amount of it that nobody would even think worthy of comment about. And if there is fraud, it's, again, as I said, election officials who are fooling around with election numbers, you know, doing stuff that did the machinery, did the electronic devices, not by voter impersonation.
Isn't it likely, though, that the theory behind, the motivation behind this is that what the Republicans really wanted to do was just to sort of demoralize the Democrats, and in many ways they already are. A lot of people on the Democratic side are disappointed with Obama, and they're not sufficiently alarmed, apparently, by the Republicans.
Maybe. I'll tell you, in the polls that I've done, that there was a really transformative moment last year that's not been, I think, widely talked about, and that's when the president proposed the second stimulus, you know, it's half the size of the first one. We could see a noticeable uptick in support and enthusiasm for the president. And, you know, the parties now are, depending on the poll, fairly even on the whole voter enthusiasm thing. Remember that, look, there'll never be quite the same enthusiasm for Obama that we saw during the historic election. I was at Denver, as I'm sure you were, and many other folks, you know, covering it for media outlets. And you know, regardless of whether you voted for the president or not, that was an historic moment that all Americans could be proud of. And I think a lot of people talked about that, even if they weren't prepared to vote for him. That kind of enthusiasm could never be generated a second time. But I think the Democrats have gone a long way. Their convention was much more, the delegates were, I was there at both, much more enthusiastic, much more on point about what they wanted to do. They had a better convention, candidly, than the Republicans did. So all in all, when you think about it, I don't think that, you know, if the intent, as you say, was to demoralize, it had the opposite effect. You know what I mean? It really did. And we've seen, and just not Democratic organizations, but a lot of what we call good government organizations, like the League of Women Voters and others. There's an organization in Philadelphia known as the Committee of 70. They exist to ensure fair elections. They're not partisan. They railed against the law and were helping, you know, to locate people who might not have the proper ID. So there's no doubt, in my humble judgment, that it made Democrats more excited and enthusiastic about it. And if that was the motive, you know, that backfired.
Well, Terry Madonna, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Terry Madonna, who's a professor of public affairs and director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College, where he directs the Franklin and Marshall College poll. He's written extensively about voters and voting behavior and founded the Keystone Poll in 1992, the oldest survey produced exclusively in Pennsylvania, which was renamed the Franklin and Marshall College Poll. He is the pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News and many other newspapers and television stations in Pennsylvania. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the concerted political and legal effort to kill the Dodd-Frank law.
You don't need to change the future's eye. You don't need to change.
Oh, give us your vote. Give us your vote.
Get from out the road when he get dull was horrible. Time is money, spend, wait, save, invest, affest. The 10K, so cave a chicken chest, S. Yes, y'all are dumb and get your trickles. The best ballers pitch in and rub to get a nickels. But tut tut, he bout to change the price again and go up each time he blow up like hydrogen. Villain here, albums shrilling in fear. And won't stop top bill until he a gazillionaire. Took a Jehovah money for Arabic Torah. Charged in advance, translated and ignored us, sorta.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Weisman, who's the president of Public Citizen and an expert on economics, healthcare, trade and globalization, intellectual property and regulatory policy, and issues related to financial accountability and corporate responsibility. He has worked to lower pharmacy prices for AIDS victims and others in the developing world. His top priorities include climate change, healthcare reform, financial regulation, and campaign finance reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Weisman.
Good to be with you.
And clearly the courts have struck a blow to the Dodd-Frank Act, particularly the provisions to prevent oil speculation and essentially neutering the ability of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission to do so as mandated by Dodd-Frank. It seems that they've managed to sort of go over this with a fine-tooth comb and find the word appropriate to be inappropriate.
Yeah, well, Dodd-Frank instructed the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which has oversight of derivatives, to issue rules to limit speculation in oil and other commodity markets. The basic idea is that no party should control too large a portion of the market, because otherwise they can manipulate the whole thing. This is known as position limits. The CFTC, the agency that was charged with issuing this new rule, took a long time to do it, was subject to a lot of pressure, and issued a rule that really was too weak. But at least it was a step forward in trying to deal with the very serious problem of oil speculation on other commodities markets. Immediately, Wall Street takes the new regulatory proposal to the courts and challenges it on multiple grounds. Last week, a court sent the rule back to the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, saying that they had not interpreted the recognized the ambiguities in Dodd-Frank sufficiently, and basically back to the drawing board.
But essentially they're saying that the Commodity Futures Trading Commission's ability to enforce position limits uses the word appropriate, and apparently the CTFC thinks that that gives them the green light, and the courts thought otherwise. And these courts, particularly the United States District Court and the District of Columbia, have basically ruled against financial regulation in the past. So what are the chances of an appeal?
Well, they're not great. On this one, it's a very strange ruling. It's kind of the worst form of lawyering. They're really saying that the agency, they didn't say the agency can't issue the rule or shouldn't issue the rule or didn't even issue the right rule. They're just saying the agency didn't interpret the law properly and they should have found that there was uncertainty in the law before they proceeded. That's a lot of legal gobbledygook, but what matters at the end of the day is the Commodity Futures Trading Commission itself is divided on this issue, and it's going to be very hard for them to press forward with an appeal, which may not do well in the appeals court. But if they also just decide, okay, we'll take the direction from the district court, we'll just go back, we'll look at the statute the way they want us to, and we'll go ahead and issue a new rule, well, they probably just won't actually get around to that. They're probably aren't three votes on the five-member commission to do that. And as you say, this is not the first ruling against Dodd-Frank rules. There's an earlier ruling, probably more important in terms of the precedent for other rules coming down the line, where the court decided to impose a very restrictive corporate-friendly requirement for how agencies should analyze rules before they can issue them, known as cost-benefit analysis. And if that kind of approach is going to be applied by the courts as the Dodd-Frank rules are finally issued, we're going to see rule after rule struck down or very significantly weakened. And what we're seeing already is that the agencies that are supposed to issue the rules under Dodd-Frank are pretty scared to do so because, among other things, they're worried about being challenged in court.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Weissman, who's the president of Public Citizen, and we're talking about a District of Columbia court issuing a ruling last week striking down a key part of the Dodd-Frank rule on oil speculation limits. And obviously, the people that are representing the speculators who brought the suit, they're out to make money. But I'm surprised that our judiciary is so disconnected from the average American. Some of these judges must have to go to the pump and fill up their cars and notice the price. And maybe they watched 60 Minutes a year or so ago when oil was run up to $147 a barrel, when it was made clear that had nothing to do with oil companies or Saudi Arabians said it's not us. It was entirely Wall Street. You've pointed out that the CEO of Exxon, Rex Tillerson, has said speculation has added about a third above what the price of oil would normally be. And even Goldman Sachs have said that speculation has increased the price of a gallon of gas by 65 to 70 cents. So this is an assault on the American public. It doesn't provide any benefits except for those that are playing around with paper barrels of oil.
Yeah, it's a really terrible ruling, at least in terms of its impact on, you know, this crucial issue of the ability to control the oil speculators. You know, I think that this is a relatively liberal judge who put out this ruling, and an Obama appointee, and it's not so much that he's saying, look, I want to rule on the side of Wall Street. In fact, I don't think it's that at all. It's the way the law has evolved, you know, over the last several decades, thanks to a very prolonged corporate campaign to reshape both the judiciary and the laws and the way they interpret the laws. It's hard for regulators to do what they're supposed to do, and it may become increasingly hard if they're going to impose new burdens to take all kinds of corporate-friendly analyses of the alleged and potential costs of rules that they adopt. It's bad in two really serious ways. I mean, this speculation rule is very important, and exactly as you say, just to protect consumers at the pump. This is a couple steps removed, but a very direct impact on the consumer pocketbook. And then secondly, this case may be less so, but other cases that we're seeing really suggest there's going to be judicial hostility to good implementation of the already two-week Dodd-Frank law. And that's going to be a big challenge for the regulators and a big challenge for those of us who are pushing them to implement aggressively.
So, Robert Weissman, did the people who wrote the Dodd-Frank rules, did they not do a good job here to allow that ambiguity over the word appropriate, meaning that they've given this liberal judge a reason to strike it down when clear language could have empowered the CTFC to do exactly what they want to do, which is set position limits?
Yeah, yes. I think the answer is yes. This is sort of, lawyering technical stuff. A regular person might think it was clear. If there's not really any doubt at all about what the authors of this provision intended. They intended for the CFTC to issue rules on position limits, but it didn't work out to be as clear as it ought to be when this judge reviewed it.
So
again, he's not stopping. This judge himself, he's not saying that they can't do it, and he's not really imposing onerous analytic requirements on them. He's just saying you have to interpret this thing slightly differently, jump through a different hoop, and then you can go ahead and issue whatever rule you want. It just happens that that's going to make it unlikely that there are three members of the commission who are ready to push through a rule, let alone a stronger one than what they had earlier adopted.
Well, the makeup of the commission, and it's worth noting that the Republicans in the House who fought against the consumer protection organization that was started by Elizabeth Warren, and they didn't want to seat the new head. They argued, of course, that we need a commission, not the powers that this new consumer protection agency has. And, of course, commissions are easy to divide and conquer. And for the longest time, one of the Democrats on the CTFC voted with the Republicans. And now you've got a guy in there who's from Goldman Sachs, Gary Gensler, but he seems to have sort of had a road to Damascus conversion, hasn't he? I mean, at least he seems to be trying to do something on behalf of the consumer.
Yeah, all that is right. Gensler has turned out to be remarkably good, very surprisingly so, given where he comes from and even his past record in public service. He's really done a good job, but exactly as you say, it's been hard for him to carry three votes on the five-member commission, including on this rule where they were able to do it, but where the third member voted for the rule because he said he had no choice because of the congressional mandate, so he did what he thought Congress mandated it to him to do, what Congress did intend to mandate him to do. But now with this judge saying, look, the mandate from Congress isn't so clear and you've got to look at the statute differently, it seems unlikely that this third vote is going to stay a third vote for a position limit rule, since he said he really didn't, he basically did it kicking and screaming.
I see. Again, I'm speaking with Robert Weissman, president of Public Citizen, and it's pretty clear that having failed to block Dodd-Frank, the Republicans who now control the House of Representatives, they've fought tooth and nail to repeal the act. But there's also a two-pronged strategy here with the courts. And you've mentioned earlier some other lawsuits. There's been a flood of lawsuits in federal courts challenging the Dodd-Frank rule and by claiming that regulators have used the improper cost-benefit analysis. And this seems to be the rubric by which they try to defeat it. And you've had three conservative judges on the Court of Appeals in the D.C. Circuit rule in the Business Roundtable and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce versus the Securities and Exchange Commission. That there's a chance isn't there a pretty good chance that this is going to get to the Supreme Court? And even though it won't get the publicity of Obamacare, the ACA, it's just as vital in many ways. And, we have a pretty corporatist Supreme Court. So walk us through the likelihood of a big chunk of Dodd-Frank being struck down by the Supreme Court.
Well, I don't know if it's going to get to the court, but just to sort of step back and go over what you just said, it's you're getting again exactly right. So so Dodd-Frank passes over the massive opposition of Wall Street. That it passed at all was a victory, that there are a lot of good things in it was a victory, but of course far too weak compared to what it should have been. So the law now exists. The law creates one important new agency, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and then charges the many financial regulatory agencies with issuing a couple hundred new rules, many of which are very important to control Wall Street and the big banks. So what happens? Well, the old financial regulators weren't exactly tough regulators. They were pretty friendly with the industry. Then the industry launches a massive all-out lobbying blitz to block, delay, or weaken the rules. So the agencies are behind or failing to meet deadlines 80% of the time, to the extent that Dodd-Frank actually gave specific deadlines on when rules should be issued. Eventually, at least in some cases, the agencies get around to issuing the rules that they're supposed to do. And then immediately, at least in many of these cases, the industry trade associations and other affected businesses are challenging the rules in court. We had the one that we've just been talking about with the position limits, and then also, very importantly, the case that you're referencing. In that case, which had to do with the ability of shareholders to get issues on the ballot for consideration by shareholders, known by term proxy voting, the court held that the Securities and Exchange Commission hadn't conducted a sufficiently rigorous cost-benefit analysis to assess the ups and downs of the rule that it proposed. So cost-benefit analysis on its face seems reasonable, like who wouldn't think about what's good and what's bad about a decision they're making. But what it really is a faux fake science, very corporate-friendly science manipulated by industry routinely to suggest the cost of new rules will be very high and the benefits will be very low or maybe shouldn't even be counted at all. But when you apply it to something like this proxy access rule, whether it's the ability of shareholders to get onto the ballot, we're really talking about shareholder democracy. It just doesn't make any sense at all. And the costs really aren't very great despite the inflated numbers from business. But the benefits don't lend themselves to monetization. I mean, what's the monetary benefit of saying shareholders get to have some control over what the executives of the company they own do? You can't really put a number on it. Or if you say we have something called the Volcker Rule, which is trying to aim in part to prevent the financial system from melting down again, in that case, you're talking about a percentage chance of something like Armageddon. I mean, how do you just treat that as a benefit? The system of cost-benefit analysis is a terrible fit for looking at financial regulation. It's not really good anywhere, but it's a terrible fit for financial regulation. Nonetheless, the courts have said, at least in this one important case, that it's required. And I don't know if that issue is ever going to get to the Supreme Court, but if that becomes the prevailing view of how financial regulators have to treat the rules that they're obligated to issue under Dodd-Frank, it's going to be, first of all, hard for them to get the rules out at all, because it's just sometimes hard, nearly impossible, to conduct these kind of analyses. And second, it's going to be really hard for them to issue rules nearly as strong as they ought to, because this pretend science of cost-benefit analysis is heavily weighted for corporate interests. And when courts look at what agencies do, they're basically going to give credence to the numbers that come from the regulated groups, from Wall Street, and it's going to be really hard for the regulators to explain the dollar value of the benefits they're accruing. So we're looking at a systemic threat to the modest reforms we won on Dodd-Frank, and these court challenges, we don't know how they're going to turn out yet at scale, but the early signs are very, very worrisome.
Well, it does seem that the playing field is so tilted. I mean, here you are on the side of the consumer, and it doesn't sound like you, as president of Public Citizen, Robert Weissman, you're up against an avalanche of Wall Street lobbyists who have basically got the Republican Congress in their pocket, but are weighing in relentlessly with unlimited funds. What I find extraordinary about it is, and again, it gets back to this alternative universe that we mortals are in. These are the people. The Wall Street people are the people that took the global economy to a near-death experience. They were bailed out by the taxpayers, but they cost $19 trillion in household wealth for Americans was lost. 8.7 million jobs disappeared, and 6.3 million more Americans sank below the poverty line. That's the damage that they've done. They and these modest attempts to prevent them from doing it again, they've managed to pretty much neuter them. What does it say about who's out there on behalf of the citizen as opposed to the power of the banking lobby?
Well, I mean, that's exactly right. It is an alternative universe, and it's exactly right to step back and remind ourselves of the cost of what this industry did to us. You know, if you apply cost-benefit analysis to the financial industry itself, at least as it's currently configured, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer. There's far too much Wall Street compared. If you look at the risks that they impose on us, the costs that they impose us, the routine rip-offs from the big banks imposed on us, as against the benefits they offer, you know, they do provide important services in terms of providing consumers with banking services or access to capital, but not at the scale that they're operating. And you're exactly right. And we face big challenges going ahead. There's no question that if you look at the calamity that they created and just the very modest remedial measures that passed Congress and that themselves are now being undermined, you can't help but conclude that this system is seriously, seriously broken.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Robert Weissman.
Great to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Weissman, who's the president of Public Citizen and an expert on economics, healthcare, trade and globalization, intellectual property and regulatory policy, and issues related to financial accountability and corporate responsibility. He's worked to lower pharmacy prices for AIDS victims and others in the developing world, and his top priorities include climate change, healthcare reform, financial regulation, and campaign finance reform. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about Boss Rove inside Karl Rove's Secret Kingdom of Power.
That's how we start the show. Eagle soar and oil flow. You didn't decide what you chose. We will pay back what they owe. Crime depends from who you sold. We cheer for the villains though. Hustling, bustling, getting low. Motion is perpetual. We call Jill to give and go. All you reap is what you sow. No, where are the controls? Mass of individuals consuming as ritual. You ain't hear them say ride slow. Dudes, don't let them play us. Girls, they are.
Behind the scenes, they grow their schemes, hiding intentions, revealing all fractures. We'll keep on whispering their mantras. We'll keep on whispering.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Craig Unger, the author of American Armageddon, The Fall of the House of Bush, and the New York Times bestseller House of Bush, House of Saud, the former deputy editor of the New York Observer and editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine. He has written about George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush for The New Yorker, Esquire, and Vanity Fair, where he is a contributing editor. His new book, just out, is Boss Rove, Inside Karl Rove's Secret Kingdom of Power. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Unger.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And Craig, your new book, I think, is vital reading for any American who cares about their democracy. And clearly we're in a time where our democracy, its very foundations are open to question, because Democrats who voted and who are eligible to vote, who want to vote Democrat, are now being expected to prove who they are. Meanwhile, a handful of billionaires that are buying the election for the Republicans don't have to reveal who they are. So the whole playing field is completely askew, don't you think?
Absolutely. And I think Karl Rove plays a really vital role in this. A lot of people wrote him off after 2008, and he sort of left the Bush administration in disgrace, and the Bush left with a 22% approval rating. But Rove has come back as king of the super PACs, and as a result, he presides over an empire that has roughly $1 billion to spend in the upcoming election.
And it seems that people who, particularly on the left, those that listen to Pacifica, have this idea that there's no difference between the two parties, even though what happened in 2000 in Florida perhaps should have indicated that there was a difference. We wouldn't have had the Iraq War, etc., had the guy that actually won, Gore, in spite of his failures, been able to, had the vote been properly counted. So if that didn't prove that every vote counts, I don't think what could prove any more that every vote counts is the fact that Karl Rove is trying to take your vote away. So if you don't think your vote's valuable, he sure as hell thinks your vote is valuable. That's why he wants to suppress it.
Right. I couldn't agree more. And one of the reasons I focus on Rove is if you look at the United States Supreme Court, partly as a result of presidential elections, no person has benefited from the Supreme Court more than Karl Rove. In 2000, of course, the Supreme Court in Bush v. Gore effectively decided who was president of the United States and made it Rove's candidate. And then again in 2010, in the Citizens United decision, again in a very controversial, highly partisan 5-4 vote, they decided that billionaires could effectively buy the elections, and Karl Rove, immediately after Citizens United, Karl Rove had a luncheon at his house with about 24 power brokers, and the super PAC was born, American Crossroads and Crossroads GPS, and he started coordinating literally hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars.
And Crossroads GPS and other super PACs that are 501c4s, allegedly in the name of social welfare, that's how the IRS categorizes them, those that donate do not have to reveal who they are, and you can create these vehicles overnight, and you can dissolve them after the elections. So they are incredibly, you know, ephemeral vehicles, if you will, yet they have the power of anonymity. And I just find it extraordinary, because what is quite clear here is that we don't know how much money corporate America is pouring into these Crossroads GPS 501c4s, because they're concerned about half their customers are Democrats and half their customers are Republican. And even though they would probably prefer to vote Republican, they're restrained from doing it publicly. But privately and anonymously, isn't there a likelihood there's a lot of corporate money pouring into the Republican coffers?
Well, absolutely. And you have these big billionaires like Bob Perry is a Texas billionaire. Harold Simmons is another Texas billionaire who's been with Rove for really roughly 30 years. And if you look back and to how Rove got his start in Texas in the 80s, he started political action committees that were supportive of tort reform, and effectively they saved a lot of companies such as big pharmaceutical companies, tobacco companies. They saved them billions and billions of dollars in product liability cases in return for money that was contributed to these political action committees.
Again, I'm speaking with Craig Unger, the author of the brand new book, Boss Rove, Inside Karl Rove's Secret Kingdom. And this book is a vital reading, particularly at this moment in time where we're only weeks away from an election that Karl Rove singularly, because of his power and influence, is both trying to buy and trying to steal. And he did, in many ways, steal the 2004 election, which is made very, very clear in this book, Boss Rove, Inside Karl Rove's Secret Kingdom of Power, by the multiple means that you just mentioned, Craig Unger, the various tricks of the trade. But, of course, key to the ability to do this was this secret program that he was running through a company called Smart Tech that was headed up by a fellow called Mike Connell. And walk us through that whole process all the way up to Mike Connell's death. Mike Connell was the only person who really had the goods on Karl Rove. And when he died in a plane crash, his sister Shannon said his death would have been a really nice Christmas present for Karl Rove. But let's go back to election night itself in 2004. In the state of Ohio, we know that Obama has to win the state of Ohio. So does Romney. It is the key state. And the exit polls put John Kerry, what, 3 or 4 points ahead? And
it
yet
4.2%. 4.2. Yes.
So let's start with the key moment at 11:15 on election night.
Right. You know, one of the amazing things about Ohio, one of the amazing things about American election law is the Secretary of State in each state is in charge of overseeing fair and impartial elections. But in this case, and it was the same in Florida in 2000, the Republican Secretary of State, Ken Blackwell, was co-chairman of the Bush-Cheney campaign. And he gave out a contract as such to help, because he felt the Secretary of State's computer systems were not robust enough to handle all the queries for election night. So he gave out a contract to another company called Smart Tech. And this is what is so controversial, because Smart Tech was a highly, highly partisan Republican tech company. And I asked Karl Rove about it in person when I met him in Ohio. He said he'd never heard of Smart Tech. I frankly am not sure whether to believe him, because his own emails were on Smart Tech computers. George W. Bush 43.com was on Smart Tech computers. The Republican National Committee's websites were on Smart Tech computers. So were Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. Almost every right-wing group you can think of was on Smart Tech computers, and they were in charge of helping out the Secretary of State in Ohio on election night. And what happened at 11:14 was, as the night had been wearing on, the returns came in, and increasingly it looked like it was going to be Florida and Ohio. Whoever won those states would be the next president. And around 11 o'clock, Florida was called for George Bush, and that meant everything depended on Ohio. So suddenly, millions of people started logging on the Secretary of State's computers for Ohio to figure out what the returns were coming in. And their traffic shot up 700% in a matter of minutes, which meant at exactly 11:14 p.m., the failover site, which was run by Smart Tech, kicked in. And suddenly, the results that were being displayed were controlled not just by the Secretary of State's office in Columbus, but also by Smart Tech's computers in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Computers which were run by a company that was highly, highly partisan. I took the county results as they came in, and I gave them to a couple of people who had studied the results in Ohio very, very thoroughly. They spent years investigating it. And they looked at the 10 counties that came in just before 11:14, and they said, well, and I didn't tell them when they came in, by the way. And they said, well, these 10 counties seem clean. It doesn't seem like anyone was messing with these results. And then I gave them the 14 counties that came in immediately after that, 11:14 p.m., and they said, well, all these are screwed up, and they were filled with anomalies. And again, every single anomaly favored George Bush and Dick Cheney. So there's just an extraordinary, you know, it's hard to believe all of that is a coincidence. What I found as I began to investigate, too, is that again and again, all the key evidence disappeared, and there were civil suits filed to investigate this. The courts had, by court order, all ballots in the presidential race were to be impounded, and yet millions of ballots were destroyed, and that was never explained. I talked to Jennifer Bruner, who was the next, who succeeded, a Democrat, who succeeded Ken Blackwell as Secretary of State, and who vowed to investigate whether there was fraud in Ohio in 2004. And a few weeks before she officially took office, she went by her new office unexpectedly, unannounced, and she walked in and she saw Ken Blackwell's staff, the Republican Secretary of State and his staff, were shredding thousands and thousands of documents. And finally, There was, as I say, a civil suit about all this. And the key figure in this was, as you mentioned, a man named Mike Connell. And his company had helped design this failover site that worked with Smart Tech. He has been described as Karl Rove's cyber guru. He had worked on all the Bush sites, on George W. Bush's sites, on Jeb Bush's sites. He had worked with Rove on many, many different elections. And he was deposed once. He was a little reticent about his testimony, and he was being deposed a second time. But just before that happened, on December 19th, 2008, he had a private plane, and he went up in his private plane and crashed and was killed and has not been heard from again.
But my understanding, Craig Unger, and you obviously talked to Mike Connell's sister and Shannon and his wife, hadn't he undergone a kind of, I wouldn't say a conversion so much as pangs of conscience had visited him, and he was apparently disgusted with the political machinations, and that he was a kind of decent sort of Midwestern farm boy and was having second thoughts about what he'd done?
Well, that's quite possible. I talked to three key people. As you say, I talked to Connell's sister, I talked to his wife, and I also talked to a friend of his named Stephen Spoonamore, who was another cybersecurity expert. And Spoonamore makes that case very strongly. Connell's wife does disagree and says she takes issue with Spoonamore, and frankly, it's one of these cases where you have conflicting testimony. But Spoonamore was a Republican himself. He had worked for Rudy Giuliani. He was sort of a John McCain Republican, and he felt there was an enormous amount of fraud and sort of cyber warfare going on in the Republican Party in terms of electronic fraud in the elections. And he's one of the people, and I talked to him at great length about what happened in Ohio, and he believes there was what he calls a man-in-the-middle attack in which Smart Tech interfered with the election results. And in Boss Rove, I go into that in great length. Connell's sister is a woman named Shannon Connell, and she was not that close to his brother, but she felt he may have been undergoing a bit of a shift. And Connell's wife, however, disagrees and is less, sort of thinks his death was an accident. I myself found it very hard. It's very difficult to investigate a plane crash, and there was a National Traffic Safety Board investigation, which suggested that the plane may have been gone down by an accident because of icing. Whether that's true or not, I think the answer is simply inconclusive. And the final word I really gave to Shannon, Mike Connell's sister, and she sort of said, look, there are only two possibilities. It was either an accident or it was murder. And if it was an accident, Karl Rove is one of the luckiest men in the world.
But is that to suggest that Mike Connell had the smoking gun in terms of Karl Rove? And was there any indication that Karl Rove, who has, obviously been a genius at covering his rear end, as we saw with the Valerie Plame thing, how vulnerable was he to what Mike Connell knew?
Well, I can't really speak to what Mike Connell absolutely knew, and it's possible he was highly knowledgeable. It's also possible that he was not. But Rove has been brilliant at doing operations with no fingerprints, and what I try to show in this in Boss Rove is how does he work, and he's a master of putting together unseen mechanisms of power. I talked to Larry Johnson, who was a former CIA agent, who could only sort of say wistfully with admiration, look, at the CIA we could have learned an awful lot from Karl Rove. And if you look at a company like Smart Tech, Rove says he's never heard of it. And when I looked into who was behind it, I went through one a long Byzantine series of companies that and ownership changes. And finally, I traced it back, and I found that the original money came from two very wealthy Republicans, Mercer Reynolds and Bill DeWitt. And Mercer Reynolds had been finance chairman of the Republican Party in 2004 and raised about $240 million for Bush and Cheney. And Reynolds and DeWitt had both bailed out George W. Bush in his oil ventures. So they were very, very close to Rove and to Bush, and I talked to Rove about them, and he acknowledged that he knew Mercer Reynolds quite well. So there I think you have the pedigree of this company and the fact that it was serving Swift Boat for Veterans for Truth, which again Rove says he has nothing to do with, but these mechanisms surface in every single race that Rove runs. There's political action committees that take out ads that are supposedly not coordinated, but they hit up they have vicious attack ads against the Republican candidate. You have what are known as push polls. Push polls are backed by, again, an independent group that can't be traced to Rove, and they hire university students who start asking poses if they're pollsters, and they say, they make phone calls, are you registered to vote? What party are you affiliated? Does it bother you that the Democrat is a lesbian? The Democrat is said to be a pedophile? That John McCain is said to have fathered a baby with an African-American prostitute? And these rumors have been going out in one race after another, in which Karl Rove has a candidate, and I think you're going to see it again in 2012.
Well, just in closing, the fact that we're talking about 2004 election and how much Karl Rove behind the scenes was able to get a victory for his boss, the boss's boss, George W. Bush, and it just gives you chills about what's happening now with this key state of Ohio and the extent to which Karl Rove, as you've mentioned, has been saying not to believe the polls, that Romney's still got a good shot at it. If they are to pull off the same stunts they did in 2004 and presumably on a bigger scale because they have more money and they're more obviously sophisticated since then, it's going to be a hell of a thing, isn't it?
I have to say the raise, you know, my feeling is they're capable of doing this kind of thing when it's close. But it has to be reasonably close, or it's otherwise just not believable.
Right.
And this race is at that point where, I forget the exact number, but I believe Obama had a 9 or 10 point lead, according to some polls in Ohio, and that's a pretty big lead. So you'd have to suspend a lot of belief if it were to shift dramatically in Romney's favor.
By the way, Craig, Bill Clinton refutes that notion that he thinks that the polls tell you one thing, but there is no real reading on turnout. And we know that the Republicans are fired up, but we don't know that the Democrats are fired up. And, you know, of course, Samuel Jackson has got this video out telling people to wake the F up, you know. So there is that factor, isn't there?
There is, and you know, when I see the polls and I learn about voter suppression, and Obama has a comfortable lead in Pennsylvania, but if those voter ID laws go into effect, it could disenfranchise as many as 800,000 people in Pennsylvania. Well, are they included in the polls? I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, again, your book just out, Boss Rove, Inside Karl Rove's Secret Kingdom of Power, Craig Unger. It's so important to understand who this guy is and how the extraordinary power he has and how much he is determined to affect our lives. He already has. He's already, in many ways, responsible or at least helped Bush get his second term by fair means or foul, and will do whatever he can to have Romney elected in 2012. But what makes him tick? The idea that his hero is Mark Hanna and McKinley, the candidate of the plutocrats in the last Gilded Age. I just don't understand how a human being living in an American democracy could worship power and privilege. I mean, imagine there are a lot of people like that. It's just, they're just so alien to me. I'm just trying to understand what makes this guy tick.
Right. Well, I think part of it, that when he talks about Mark Hanna, it's partly that his strategically he helped usher in an era of Republican domination, and he saw it as a historic realignment of the electorate. And Rose has tried to position himself as doing that for this era, creating what he calls a permanent Republican majority. Now, in fact, things have turned out very, very differently for him. And in 08, all those dreams were dashed completely. The Democrats won the trifecta. They won the House, the Senate, the White House. Rove's boss, of whom he was the architect of his administration, George W. Bush, left the White House with a 22% approval rating, the lowest in history. So now Rove is faced with building this permanent Republican majority. But in fact, in demographic terms, the growth of the Hispanic population strongly, strongly favors the Democrats in coming years. And that's why you see them having to resort to very desperate measures like voter suppression, all these voter ID laws. And we're going to see a lot of that happening now. I think people are starting to wake up to it a bit. Rove had started it in 04, and he had associates. A guy named Mark Hearn went out and filed 65 lawsuits all over the country trying to get voter IDs required and so forth, and to make registration very difficult. This is the return of Jim Crow in many ways. People are calling it Jim Crow 2.0, or in some cases, Juan Crow, because it's directed in part at Hispanics. But it could really reshape the electorate. And to me, it's on its face, it's profoundly undemocratic. It's saying, we don't want you guys to vote. What could be more undemocratic than that?
Well, that's the point that I'm trying to make to people here on the American left, or at least the far left, who honestly believe there's no difference between the two and that they're all owned by the rich and powerful, all of which is true, but there are degrees of difference that are quite critical. And if you think your vote doesn't count, well, Karl Rove sure as hell thinks your vote counts. That's why he's desperately trying to suppress it. And he may even be able to pull it off for a second time in 2012. Well, Craig Unger, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Again, I've been speaking with Craig Unger, the author of American Armageddon, The Fall of the House of Bush, and the New York Times bestseller House of Bush, House of Saud. He's the former deputy editor of the New York Observer and editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine, and he's written about George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush for The New Yorker, Esquire, and Vanity Fair, where he is a contributing editor. His new book, just out, is Boss Rove, Inside Karl Rove's Secret Kingdom of Power. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Tariq Mohammed. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments, and the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.